You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at the ways to reduce teen and young adult unplanned pregnancies and births. The statistics are well established. A young unwed mother giving birth dramatically increases her likelihood that her family will be a family in poverty. And it can dramatically affect the child's well-being and future prospects. In fact, my guest today says that unplanned pregnancies and a lack of a strong family unit is a major contributor to an emerging class divide, economic inequality, and a drop in social mobility in the United States. Dr. Isabel Sawhill is an economist and a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution and the co-director of the Center on Children and Families there. She's also a founder of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. Today, she's president of the board of the directors. Prior to joining Brookings, she was a senior fellow at the Urban Institute and before that, an associate director of the Office of Management and Budget during the Clinton administration. She's the author of numerous books on the federal budget, budget priorities, and family and children's issues. Her latest is titled Generation Unbound, Drifting into Sex and Parenthood Without Marriage. And while the left and right argue about whether to offer more support for single families or to bolster traditional marriage, Sawhill argues for a third approach, reducing the number of unplanned pregnancies with the goal of making every new birth a planned decision with the full support of, hopefully, two partners. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Sawhill, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure to be with you.
Today, over half of all births to young adults occur outside of marriage, and a majority of those are unplanned. Taking aside all the religious and morality elements of that, social conservatism and all, just from a straight economic standpoint, what are the most likely outcomes from an early unplanned pregnancy?
I think the most likely outcome is poverty for the family and for the children involved. So I think we have to focus on this set of issues if we want to do anything about high rates of child poverty in the United States. Also leads to more inequality and less social mobility for those children over time.
Now, from a progressive point of view, this has really been an issue of social conservatism for the most part, hasn't it?
I think that's right. Amongst liberal or progressive groups, there's a fear of blaming the victim, if you will, and appearing to say to these young single moms, well, you shouldn't have done that, when really the progressive view is we should be helping these mothers to do the best job they can raising their kids, and I agree that they need help. But I think if we only focus on helping these young families, struggling families after the children are born, we will miss an opportunity to help them before the children are born. So I think we have to focus more on preventing these young unplanned births outside of marriage.
Give us a sense of the disparity between a young woman who has an unplanned pregnancy and a child versus one who doesn't, and also the results for that child, too, from being a result of not having a stable home life as far as a marriage or committed two partners raising the child.
Right. Well, in addition to the very high rates of poverty amongst these families, often four or five times, by the way, as much as for a two-parent family, there are some other adverse consequences for the children. They don't do as well in school. They're likely to have various behavioral problems as teenagers and end up not doing as well, even as adults, as those raised in two-parent families. So there are lots of adverse consequences for the kids, and there's just a ton of research now that suggests that. And contrast having a child very early in life that you didn't expect to have with the old-fashioned way that people formed families, which was to finish school, then maybe experiment with various relationships until you found someone you were willing to make a long-term commitment to, typically within marriage, and then getting married and having children after you were married. I call that the success sequence, And if more people followed that kind of trajectory, we would have a lot less child poverty and a lot less in the way of social problems of various sorts.
One of the things you do is sort of redefine how we view marriage as this activator of social mobility and economic benefit. What are the benefits of that latter description that you just gave us?
You know, the marriage has, as you suggested, all of this sort of moral and religious connotation around it. But I think just from a pure economic perspective, we should remember that when you have two adults who've combined forces within marriage, they have twice as much time, and that time can be devoted either to earning more income or to spending more time with kids. So two parents just have a lot more resources to devote to one of the most important tasks anyone ever undertakes, which is to raise children. You know, their incomes are much higher. It's not only because they're married that their incomes are higher. They tend to be better educated and have other characteristics that make them high-earning individuals. But two incomes is always better than one. Even if you only are earning $10 an hour, you're going to make $20,000 a year in a full-time job. And there isn't any social program that can add an extra $20,000 to a family's income. And for better or worse, in today's economy, it's very hard to have a middle-class lifestyle or above unless you have two earners in the family or one earner who has a really high-paid job on Wall Street or something equivalent to it.
Your book's subtitle uses the term drifting into sex and parenthood. And why use that particular term, drifting?
You know, I chose that word very deliberately and carefully. And the reason I did is because so many of these pregnancies that lead to these young families, unmarried families, are the result of people not planning to have children at all, but drifting into it. Now, they aren't exactly not planning either. Many of them are quite ambivalent about having children, and many of them come to love and try to do the best that they can for their children after they're born. But they really aren't ready to be parents, and they really aren't making planful decisions about whether to have children or not, or who to have them with, or when to have them. That's why I call it drifting, because they're drifting, not planning.
Well, earlier in our conversation, we talked about that today half of all births to young adults occur outside of marriage, and I think it's something like 75% of those, or even a little more than that, are unplanned. Which is more important, the marriage or the planning of the pregnancy? Of the two?
That's a really interesting question. Before I wrote this book, and based on a lot of research and writing I'd done earlier in my career, I would have said marriage was quite key and maybe the critical variable. And of course, historically, it's been the institution within which we've been able to have stably committed adults who stayed with their kids from birth to adulthood. And, you know, the more I've thought about it, the more I think that the reason marriage has been important is because of that stability that it's provided and because of the commitment of the adults involved, both to each other and to the child. But I really think it's the commitment that matters and the stability. And let's suppose you were a young woman and you'd been searching for Mr. Right for many years and he just hadn't come along, and you're now 35, let's say, and your biological clock is ticking, you might at that point decide to plan to have a child or adopt a child, but be extraordinarily committed and in good circumstances to raise that child. And I think that that scenario is better than a scenario of two people in their early 20s who drift into parenthood, aren't committed to each other, and the mother and the child end up going it alone and having all kinds of problems.
It's kind of interesting.
I still think marriage is the best and ideal situation, but just pointing out it isn't going to happen all the time.
Well, you know, you just described the Murphy Brown situation. Of course, for those, that's so old now that people have to be reminded. But of course, 23 years ago or so.
That's right.
It was enormous controversy when this character on a television show, Murphy Brown, Candace Bergen, the character on the show decided to have a child alone. You know, she was a professional woman. You know, it gives you a sense of how, for so many generations, birth outside of marriage was just considered this major breach of social norms. But that has changed completely. And it seems like in your book, you're making an argument that progresses. You need to get beyond this left and right divide of for the sake of the children and for social mobility, which you return to all the time, that this is an important part of that stability or glue that keeps two people together, raising a child together, and that child was planned.
I think that's right. It's very interesting. The Murphy Brown story does go back to a time when Dan Quayle was vice president, and he made a speech criticizing this television character for who was a professional and who decided to have a child outside of marriage. But she was a planner. She was not a drifter. And so that is why I make the distinction between marriage per se and stably committed relationships in which a child was really wanted and planned for.
You actually defended him at the time, right?
I did defend him. I was asked to write a piece by the Washington Post on this, and I did, and I defended his position. Because I think social norms are important, and I thought, as he argued, that Murphy Brown was sending the wrong message to young people, sort of saying it's just fine to have a baby on your own. And even though she could afford it and was ready for it, that didn't mean that she should be sending that message to everyone else. But I do think social norms have changed so much now, just in the last 23 years, even, that I'm getting more pessimistic about whether we can bring marriage back. And if we can't bring marriage back, even though it would be very beneficial to children, I think the next best thing we could do would be to make sure that people feel ready to be parents before they make the leap, and that they do so in an intentional way. And one of the things I like to talk about is the old story about a village that had a river running through it, and there are children that are drifting down the river, and they're at risk of drowning, and there's a guy in the village who's pulling them out to save their lives. But it never stops. There are just more and more children drifting down the river at risk of dying. And finally, he sends a friend upstream to see what's going on, and it turns out there's a guy upstream who's throwing the kids in as fast as he can pull them out. And I think that's kind of where we are now as a country. Whatever social programs we have, and I'm in favor of you know, a better education system and some supports for single parents, we can't just continue to rely on social programs to help these families. We have to do something about preventing their formation in the first place.
My guest today is Dr. Isabel Sawhill. She's a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution, president of the board for the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy, and she was actually a founder of that organization. She's the author of Generation Unbound, Drifting into Sex and Parenthood Without Marriage. One of the things you put out there in the book Generation Unbound is the idea of changing drifters into planners. Give us some of the strategies for doing that.
Well, I think there are basically two. First of all, you have to give young people more hope for the future. If they think that they have good prospects educationally and in terms of jobs and careers, they will be better motivated to try to plan their families and not have a baby too early and before they're ready. But secondly, I think we have to give them the means as well as the motivation to prevent these early unplanned births outside of marriage. And we have some ability to do that now that we're not fully utilizing, and that is to encourage more people to use long-acting reversible contraceptives. That means things like the IUD and the implant. And right now, very few women in the U.S. are taking advantage of those forms of contraception. They don't even know that they exist in many cases. And even if they know that they exist, they think they're unsafe. And that's not true. They are both safe and effective, according to the American College of OBGYNs and also the American Academy of Pediatricians. So you all have some very effective efforts there in Oklahoma and in Tulsa to help make this more available at low cost, especially to lower-income women. And I think that's something worth cheering about, and I'm hoping it's going to make a difference.
Now, I know several test projects have done some work in giving out LARCs in various communities where there have been high rates of teen pregnancy. What do the results from those studies look like?
The results from these studies are really eye-opening and terribly encouraging, in my view. They are using this in Colorado. All around the state, they have clinics where they make all forms of contraception available for free to lower-income families, and they have reduced their pregnancy rates, unplanned pregnancy rates, quite dramatically, especially amongst teenagers, but also amongst some young adults as well. And I think that that's been something that needs to be copied in other states. We've also seen good results in Iowa and in Missouri in the St. Louis region. So we now have some great data that this can make a difference. If people get the right kind of counseling about contraception and have it made available to them at either no cost or very low cost. Right now, most young adults and teenagers are relying either on condoms or pills, and those are not nearly as effective as long-acting contraception. The main reason is because we all make mistakes, and we forget to take a pill, or we forget to get our prescription refilled, or it has side effects, and these new but little-used forms of contraception change all of that.
And of course, condoms are often one of the most common forms of birth control, and the failure rate is, it's not huge, but it's significant.
Well, it's quite staggering. When I tell people that if you and your partner are using condoms to prevent a pregnancy, your chances of getting pregnant over a five-year period are 63%, they sort of say, wow, didn't know that. Now, condoms are still important for preventing sexually transmitted diseases, but they are not a great way of preventing pregnancy.
Now, anytime you start looking at LARCs or long-acting reversible contraceptives and IUDs and any sort of birth control, all of a sudden you're back into this culture war situation where you have social conservatives that say that this shouldn't be a part of the policy. How do you get them to move beyond that to see the bigger goal?
Well, you're exactly right that there has been some pushback from political and conservatives. They believe that some of these forms of contraception, such as IUDs, are abortifacients. The medical community would dispute that and say they are not abortifacients, but that doesn't prevent some people believing otherwise. It's a little bit like the whole debate over climate change. The scientific community is on one side, and a lot of other people are on another side. In any case, I think the way you get beyond this is, first of all, by pointing out to conservatives who are often pro-life as well, that if you're pro-life, this is the most effective way by far to reduce the need for abortion. And in fact, in these studies that I mentioned earlier, abortion rates have been dramatically reduced when long-acting contraception was made available. Well, secondly, and this should be of interest especially to state elected officials, it saves a lot of money if you can get people to use long-acting forms of contraception, because it means a lot fewer babies being born into poor families. Right now, 48% of all children in America are born on Medicaid. And one Medicaid birth costs about $13,000. So, you know, this is a way to not only improve the lives of these children and their parents, but also to save money for the government and reduce abortion all in one fell swoop.
Now, of course, we've had a whole round, another round of abstinence-only sex education throughout the South and through a lot of the conservative regions of the country. Has that done damage?
I think many parents, I would be in this camp myself, think that the best choice for teenagers is abstinence.
Yeah.
I don't think a 14 or a 15-year-old should be having sex. I don't think they're mature enough yet to handle it. But we also know that many teens, especially older teens, are going to become sexually active, and I don't think we should close our eyes to that fact. So I think there's nothing wrong with valuing abstinence and preaching it and talking to young people about it, but I think it would be a mistake to, at the same time, not have contraceptives available and not have good sex education in the schools.
Now, one of the things you actually write about is changing the whole mindset about, instead of planning to avoid having children, we should actually change that around so that we're actually planning to have children. That's kind of an interesting term or phrase. Yeah,
I call it changing the default. And let me give you an analogy that may help. In the whole area of savings for retirement, we know that we don't have enough of it in the United States right now. And as one way to improve savings for retirement, there's been a move afoot to get more people to sign up for IRAs or 401k plans with their employer. And what we've learned is that if you tell people that they have to do something to sign up for a 401k when they're first hired, they will often not follow through. They won't do the paperwork that is required to enroll them in a plan and have some part of their paycheck deducted and go into a savings vehicle. But if you make that automatic, if you change the default from you're in the plan unless you deliberately choose to opt out of it, then participation rates in these 401k plans go way up. And so this is a similar situation. Once you're protected with a long-acting form of contraception, you have to make a deliberate decision to opt out of that. You have to go back to the doctor and have the device removed when you and your hopefully stably committed partner or married partner decide you want to have a baby. So that whole idea of changing the default has huge behavioral consequences. And we know that from research in lots of different areas.
My guest today is Isabel Sawhill, a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution and author of Generation Unbound, Drifting into Sex and Parenthood Without Marriage. That's her latest book. Now, when you say that last statement, I can just hear people saying they think of the worst sort of paternalistic government or organization sort of telling people what they can and can't do. How do you combat that?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that, because I don't think anyone, certainly not myself, is interested in telling people what to do. I think we want to make choices available to them, and we don't want there to be huge barriers to their making good choices. Right now, the barriers are, first of all, that they don't even know the facts about long-acting forms of contraception. Some people don't even know that they exist. Secondly, there's a lot of myths about them, about their health effects, which are just myths. Thirdly, there's the cost barrier. Right now, getting a long-acting contraceptive can cost anywhere between $500 and $1,000. And how many young people have that kind of money or are going to put it forward? And so nobody is sort of saying we should compel anyone or even suggest to anyone that they must use one form of contraception or any form of contraception. But we do want to make the facts available, and we do want to reduce the cost barriers, it seems to me. And in all of the efforts that have been underway around the country to do this, the clinics that are making these newer forms of contraception available are also saying to the women who come in, well, it's your choice. We want to tell you what the pros and cons are of all the different forms, but in the end, it's your choice. So I think one of the reasons there's sensitivity about this is because we have a history in this country of compulsory sterilization. Yeah. And there's nothing about this that's compulsory, and there's nothing about this that isn't reversible. So those are important distinctions to make.
Earlier when you were talking about this whole process of turning drifters into planners, you said there's two steps. One, the one we've been talking about, the means to prevent unwanted pregnancies, but better economic prospects as a way of encouraging kids to leave sex for later, and if they become sexually active, to take steps to prevent an unwanted pregnancy. What about that first step? Do you think we're doing a good enough job in sort of highlighting the economic prospects of delaying childbirth to a later age?
I think we need to do more on that front. And I have spent a good deal of my career writing about opportunity and social mobility and poverty and what we could do to give young people better futures. There are some very good efforts that have been tried to improve their prospects. I think, for example, we need more career and technical education. We've done a lot better in recent years on increasing the high school graduation rate. Something like 80% now graduate from high school. And a very large proportion of those high school graduates go on to enroll in college. But they're not finishing college. They're not completing. And so they often end up without a degree and with a lot of student debt. So I think we need to really move the needle here and say college, four-year college isn't for everyone. And we've done a rather bad job in this country of providing people with specific skills, vocational skills, if you will, that are in huge demand and employers need, and we don't have enough trained people. So I think we could kill two birds with one stone there. We could both give these young people a better future and meet some of the needs of our economy at the same time if we could figure that piece of the puzzle out.
The name of the book is Generation Unbound, Drifting into Sex and Parenthood Without Marriage. Dr. Sawhill, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Economist Isabel Sawhill speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She's a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution and the author of Generation Unbound, Drifting into Sex and Parenthood Without Marriage. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.